Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And tonight's topic is part of the series Monday Night Philosophy, which meets every second Monday of the month. Tonight's topic is about music. Pythagoras thought music matters. The reason for the series on music is because music plays an enormous role in human life, and it has lost some of the attention it used to have over the last 20 years, at least in our educational system, and so we're covering some of those topics and also just different areas of how music affects our life. Now, what does Pythagoras have to do with this? You would think, well, it's hard. How is the philosophy humanities form going to have something to say about music? But Pythagoras is actually the man whose ideas influence Western music, probably more than anyone else's, and to the extent that Western music is probably different than other parts because of some of his ideas. So I'm going to give you a real simple, straightforward reason for why that happened, because he wasn't a musician himself. He was a philosopher, which I'll explain a little bit later. He's the man who invented the word. And the music that he influenced was due to his mathematical observations. I'll put this in context later of why he was even interested in this at all. But he noticed one day, not by accident, he was out looking for things just like this, but he noticed one day that the length of the string of a lyre, if it's twice as long, it's a perfect octave, and therefore there's harmony between the two. But he noticed that there was a mathematical relationship in the length of the string, 1 to 2. How interesting. Why is that? And then he did some other, he got excited, he did some other calculations and found that when their relationship was mathematical with direct numbers like 3 to 4, the third, the fifth, and those kind of harmonies, that it created harmonious relations. Now, obviously, we know now it has to do with the vibrations along the string not causing interference and so on and so forth, but this is not known, obviously, and not seeable by people 2,500 years ago, but they could hear it, and they could hear the harmony, and this connection between the harmony and the mathematics got him very, very excited. Now I'll tell his story as to why it would be that something like that would get a man excited. So Pythagoras was born, there's a lot of arguments about it, but he was born in about 570 BC, maybe 580 BC, somewhere along there. His life, it's very hard to imagine what his life was like, because this is all pre-written history. And there's a lot of myths about him. So the way I like to go about trying to figure out what these men were really like is to see through the veil of mystery that usually surrounds them, and to see the man through the veil, a man of his time and obviously ahead of his time, both at the same time. And if we don't see them within the context of their culture, it's kind of hard to imagine that they existed. And if we don't see them as being ahead of the time, it's kind of hard to imagine why anyone would have paid any attention to them. And so it seems to me fairly easy to make those two assumptions about any man or woman who's made an impact on human culture like this. So if we pull back that veil, I think one of the first ideas that I have that I think is useful to say about this is that Pythagoras is considered a mystic and a mathematician, and this is a kind of hard combination for most people, in spite of the fact that Newton, of course, people just say, well, he dabbled in alchemy, and it was a hobby of his, but he actually spent more of his time on alchemy than he did on physics. So we have examples of top theoreticians who are also interested in other areas as well. But Pythagoras is sort of so deeply embedded in this mystery behind the veil that people can hardly imagine. Most people even say, I bet he didn't think of anything that had anything to do with mathematics, because anyone that has anything to do with mathematics couldn't possibly think about any of those other things. But that sort of really is outside the culture, to step outside the culture, to look back from the 21st century or the 20th century and say, oh my goodness, he couldn't possibly, because everybody who likes mathematics now couldn't possibly be interested in these things. So that's an anachronistic way of looking at men like this. So my idea about it is pretty much this way, The people who came forward first with reason and math and started to give us some of these ideas in ancient Greece were a lot like the first amphibians. You know, when you step out of the water, you're still wet, right? And now you're on land, but you're still wet. You still retain some of the flavor of where your environment that you come out of. And ironically, when we look back on this, I mean, Pythagoras ran a secret society, and what information did he keep secret from anyone except for people who he could trust? The fact that reason could destroy other ideas. The fact that reason and math and science were dangerous. Okay. So he was running a secret society to teach math, just to give you an idea about what kind of a culture it must have been prior to the fact that math made its progress that it did today. So I think that gives away a lot about the culture that he came from, that you need to keep this secret. It's also true that the secret societies that he learned from all practice secret. One of my favorite things along this line is in Plato's writing. Plato is writing down one of the dialogues with Socrates, and Socrates is saying, don't write anything down because it will be distorted. So you just should use an oral tradition and don't write anything down. That's a big mistake. Of course, Plato's writing it down. Otherwise, we wouldn't have it. And that, I think, is the great irony. He records Socrates as saying, don't write things down, showing that he's a rebel against his own teacher. But in addition to that, that he was right, because if we hadn't written it down, we'd have almost no idea about what Socrates was like. So in spite of the fact that writing things down can distort something and be not as effective as a small group of people which you give this oral tradition to, writing is certainly one of the great ways of passing ideas on to great numbers of people over a great period of time. And since Plato, it's been used by most people who are very interested in ideas. Some still try to keep it secret and hidden, but most people write the ideas down, and this is actually how philosophers talk to each other over centuries and so on. They write down their ideas, and they know that a lot of those ideas are incomprehensible to the people or boring to the people. They might even be boring to them, which is partly why it's slightly boring to read them. But they still think that by saying this, they can reach out to people across time who share their interests. You know, now how do we do that? We just get into chat groups on the internet, right? So everybody can find the people who are interested in exactly what they are and reinforce their thinking. So Pythagoras is in this situation. He's in a time when reason, of course, people always used reason. Now, it's not like he invented reason, but he used reason in a way that hadn't been used basically before and really got science going. So what's his background? Well, one of the myths that's told about him is that he was the son of Apollo and that he had a golden thigh, things like that. Now, you can tell when someone makes up a myth, like the man had a golden thigh, that he doesn't know anything about gold, how much it weighs. No, that kind of thing, you know. I mean, he'd be limping all the time if he had actually had a thigh made out of gold. Besides, the blood wouldn't be able to get through the back of bottom of his leg, and so on and so forth. So I think we can discount a lot of those sort of myths about him. But why would they come up with those myths? They come up with those myths because they're trying to express the fact that he kind of reminded them of the myths they'd heard about Apollo, who was all about light and shedding light on darkness and making things grow, making new things grow, that kind of thing. So he got that idea. He got that image, and then with the image comes a lot of mythology with it. But we do know some things about him. And one of the things is he was pretty lucky about his birth. He was born on Samos. Well, he wasn't born on Samos. He was born in a town, I think Tyre maybe, along the coast, the Turkish coast. His father was a trader, and his mother was from one of the old families of Samos. Now, Samos, if you visit it today, it's a small island off the what's now the Turkish coast, not that far north of Rhodes. So if you go there, there's maybe 10,000 people living in the town where Pythagoras lived his life with his family as a child. But there was a town of maybe 400,000 to 600,000 people living there at the time that he was there. This was a major power, and the dictator that ran that island was friends with the Egyptian pharaoh, and then he played the Egyptian pharaoh off of the Persian emperor, So he had a lot of power. He even had a fleet of 40 triremes at one point. And this is, you know, now you look at it and it's a small town. It's a little bit like if you were in New York City 100 years from now and there was a little village of natives living in Central Park and the whole place around it was ruined and nobody was living there. So you had 10,000 people living in an area that used to have millions. So that's what it's like to go to these places today, because it really, really was a totally different society with huge cities and a very urban culture. They dug one of the first aqueducts in that century, so the 6th century BC, an aqueduct right through the mountain to bring water from the other side of the mountain onto the dry side of the mountain. So lots of very interesting things that they could do technologically. So he was born in another place with his father was traveling with his mother, and the child was born unexpectedly. They weren't expecting it. Then there's a story that's told that they stopped at the early part of the trip at the oracle at Delphi, and that the priestess there told the couple that they were expecting a son, and they didn't even know that they were pregnant, of course. There was no ultrasounds at the time, I think you can imagine. So predicting that it was a son is a 50-50 chance. But they predicted that the son would be effective in bringing new ideas to humanity. So that sounds a lot like post-history, you know, to me. But it comes from the fact that the names that were given to Pythagoras and to his mother had to do with the Apollo aspect of the Delphic Oracle. So people then make up all this other stuff, probably. And if not, well, that oracle knew what it was doing that day. So and said it straightforward instead of in a mystery the way it usually said it. So he was born. He lived about 20 years. He did traveled with his father, who was a merchant, as I said. It was a wealthy family. It was sort of one of those families of nouveau riche, marrying the old riches, you know, because the mother was from a family that was now out of power, but that their family had been one of the 10 families that had run the island for maybe 400 years before that. So it was one of those kind of marriages have been popular for a long time. So it was one of those kind of situations. But the interesting thing was that the mother was very interested in ideas. And she realized that this son of hers, I think the oldest of her children, was a good student, bright student, and that she wanted him to go off and find all the wisdom he could and come back and tell it to her, because she had to stay home most of the time as women were kept in Greece at that time. So there's a story that he traveled all over the place, but it's fairly well known and fairly well established, as I said, most of it's myth, that he went to Egypt and probably to Babylon. He probably spent about 10 years doing this to get the right timeline. There's a lot of exaggeration that he died at 100 years old and stuff like that, but it's more likely he died in his 70s. And there's one way to tell about certain dates. There was a dictator that he had a fight with in Samos, and that dictator only ruled for about 16 years, so you can kind of tell that about right in the middle of that time is when he got kicked out, and he was supposed to be about 40 years old at that time, and that's how people date back to when he was probably born, because that fight took place in about 530. So Pythagoras went to Egypt, and he tried to get in all the secret information that he could. He tried to get into every secret society that he could and learn the things. Of course, the Greeks, this was, you know, 300 years before Alexander, so the Greeks were not unknown to the Egyptians, but they were certainly considered foreigners, outsiders, and having nothing to do with their culture. And so it was very tough for him to get in. And there's one very, very neat cross-cultural story about how he finally convinced the Egyptian priests to let him into to their mystery and to induct him. And that is that they put up a barrier in front of his ability to get the information, one after another, and he persevered through all those barriers. So finally they said, okay, we will induct you. All you have to do is meet us here at midnight, outside of our temple doors, at midnight, naked. So I said, fine. So he stood outside the doors of the temple, naked at midnight. It's dark, you know, there's no street lights. No problem. So they had him stand there all through the night until the morning, when the workers started going to work and all started laughing at him, you know, standing there naked in front of the temple. So finally the door opened up and the hand reached out and grabbed him and pulled him in, and he got to learn the mysteries. Again, ironically, probably the best mystery that he learned in all of his travels was that most mysteries aren't worth learning. That most people are hiding secret information from everybody else, saying they have secret information that really doesn't amount to something extremely useful. In this case, though, the Babylonians and the Egyptians had a lot of astronomical information that they had collected in order to create their calendars and to make sure that when the Nile flooded, that they would be able to know it was coming, and so on and so forth. And so he learned that. And while he was learning that, he did come across something that is the creation of the Pythagorean theorem. The Pythagorean theorem, which is the thing that he's most famous for, is that A squared plus B squared equals C squared. For those of you who went to middle school, you all remember that. A squared plus B squared, the length of the lines of a right triangle, and C squared being the length of the hypotenuse. Now, the way that the Egyptians and the Babylonians did this is that they created square blocks off the side of the triangle. You just imagine the triangle, and they created squares, because that's what squaring is. They squared it off, and they saw that if you took the cubes of all of the ones on these two sides, they added up to exactly the same number as the one on the other side. So they said, these things are equal. These are equal. And what Pythagoras saw was something nobody had seen in 1,500 years working with that, because it was a practical thing. He saw that this was something that was always true. And not only that, but that there was a way to probably prove that. It would always be true. And so he worked on that. Now, his proof is much simpler and probably not as complete as Euclid's from 300 years later. But he was the first one that put a proof down about why this had to be true all the time. But he took something even more away from it. And that is the concept of a concept. That is something we deal with all the time. A concept is the relationship between two things. It's always true. It's an abstract thing. Plato was very excited about the same thing. He called them eternal ideas. And they're dripping with the amphibian wet that I talked about earlier. I mean, it doesn't have to be that mystical. But if you can understand how excited people would get when they first started thinking about concepts and how it helps organize the patterns of the chaos that we see around us, it could be very exciting, very obviously very exciting. And this is what Pythagoras saw. This is his contribution. So a lot of scientists think that his name shouldn't be on it because there's some evidence that it existed before. But his contribution is much bigger than that this relationship is seen. He saw what that relationship was, that it was an always and provable relationship. And then he got excited and said, okay, what else can I see like that? One of the next things he did see was this idea in the lyre, so that he saw the musical relationship being mathematical as well. And when he saw that, not too long after that, a couple of other smaller ones, he said, all is number. He thought everything is made up of numbers. Got very excited about this concept, and all is number. You can, for those of you who are not familiar with Pythagoras but familiar with Plato, all is number is what turned into the eternal ideas theory. He took it away from number and he made it more conceptual, and then that more conceptual, people read the eternal ideas theory today and say, what is all this mystical nonsense? But it's the forerunner of our concept. It's a very simple thing to all of us. We all know what it is. But you have to put yourself at the time of the invention of the concept, the invention of explaining it and the use of it in proofs. That's what they did. So what did Pythagoras do with this, you know, Pythagorean theorem? That there's a concept with the mathematical basis of music and all is number. Well, he did a lot of different things. He influenced a lot of different areas, one of them being music. But what was he known for? Who knows what he was known for the first 100 years? He was known for his belief in reincarnation. That's what everybody talked about, because he said he could remember past lives. He said that he went into this temple of Juno at Argos, and he recognized the shield that he had used in the Trojan War as a warrior named Euphorbus. And he said, if you look on the back, you will see my name. And the other people took it down, and his name was on the back, Euphorbus. And so everybody freaked out, you know, that because he had never been in the temple before. He was traveling through, and he, et cetera, et cetera. He also was very honest about things because he also said he could remember being a prostitute. He said that it must have been his punishment for some sins in another past life. He didn't understand why he had been a prostitute, but he could remember that he had been a female prostitute in the past. He could remember about six lives. And so, of course, this was very entertaining to people. The Greeks didn't have any theory like this at all about life. So they figured he must have picked it up on his travels. But it seems to me, because the Egyptians don't have the same idea, they have a theory of the afterlife, but they don't have a theory of reincarnation. And the Babylonians don't either. It seems to me that what he did was he learned some sort of internal techniques, mystical techniques or whatever, that opened up his own memories, and therefore he was able to talk about them because he experienced them. So he went around talking about this, and this is, he was called an expert on it, but he was also made fun of. Now, one of the things that people, you know, hark back to as one of the first stories that's told about him is an example of this. But ironically, it's often said that this is proof that he believed in it when, I'll tell you the story, and then you can judge for yourself. The story is that Pythagoras was walking down the street, and he heard a dog being mistreated by a person. And the dog was being mistreated and howling and yelling, and Pythagoras was supposed to have said to the man, "Stop beating that dog. I recognize his voice. He's an old dear friend of mine." Right? Now, this is an example of how to figure out what's the truth behind something. Probably, obviously, Pythagoras was also a vegetarian. So he was probably in favor of animal rights or treating animals better, as usually goes together. In addition to that, he believed in reincarnation. So some wag made up this story to make fun of him. Just like, say, in The Clouds by Aristophanes making fun of Socrates. It was a nice sport at the time among the Greeks. And so this story that has come down seriously is just a joke that was used against Pythagoras at the time. But it does still incorporate the two of the ideas he was known for, which is usually true when people make jokes about politicians. So that's part of what it was. So part of what Pythagoras got out of all this was being teased by everybody all the time about thinking such strange ideas. Obviously, anytime you have strange ideas, you're going to be teased. It's just the way it is. Secondly, he had another even stranger idea, which was that women could learn just as well as men. And this was probably more outrageous to everybody, and he was teased tremendously about this as well. Now, as we all know now, you know, he was on the right side of that question. And I wanted to point out something about his success in that area. First of all, his mother had talked him into, you know, paid for him to go on this on these travels for 10 years. When he came back, he told his mother everything that he'd learned, obviously, and was very excited about where he was going. And then he stayed with her for another 5 or 6 years in Samos on the island before he got in his fight with the dictator, Polycrates. And then they went to, or he went, I think, after his mother died, to Croton, which is a town in the boot of Italy, but it was a Greek city at the time. So he left from one end of the Greek island area all the way to the other end in part of Italy. And because his mother had done that, he knew that, you know, women could understand this. And he met a woman in Croton who he married, who also was very interested in the ideas, and his daughters were too. Now, 800 years later, there was a man named Iamblichus, about 300 AD. And he wrote a history of Pythagorean thought, the influential Pythagorean thinkers. And on the list of 235 influential thinkers were 17 women. 17 women out of 235 doesn't seem like much, 7.2%. Right? So what do you think the percentage of women who teach mathematics as full professors to doctoral level mathematics courses in the United States is? 7.6%. And how about in philosophy? Same thing. So here was a mathematical philosopher who achieved the same sort of rate of success 2,500 years ago. So I think, you know, because I say that in more detail now because people say, well, 7.2% is not much. So he really took a hugely different stand on this issue and was successful at it. So He got to Croton, and he was a political leader as well. The people found his ideas interesting. They remade their government against the local dictator, and things went along for about 25 years. There was a fight between Croton and Sybaris. Everyone heard of the term Sybaritic? Yeah, that was the Greek version of Sodom and Gomorrah. So they were nearby, and there was a fight between them, and people have blamed him for that, blamed his followers for that, but actually the dictator got all the money, so you can probably guess who was actually behind it. And the story is told, which is fairly well documented, that Pythagoras, of course, had this secret society, and he didn't let a lot of people into the society. If they didn't seem like they were genuinely interested, then he didn't teach them. And if they were genuinely interested, then he made them learn mathematics for 3 years, knowing that that would probably get rid of anyone who especially back then, but that would get rid of anyone who wasn't really serious about it. Well, so one of the local leaders of one of the leading families wanted to come in, and he asked him to go through the mathematics course like everybody else, and the man was insulted, and then he came back again and said he would decide to do it, and he started taking the math courses and dropped out. And then went to Pythagoras and asked him, could he, you know, get into the secret society, learn the secret stuff anyway? And Pythagoras said, no, everybody has to go through this one thing. So obviously this man developed a great antipathy for Pythagoras and developed fight against him. He got a bunch of followers, and they went and they burned down the building that everybody was in to meet about an idea. And most of the Pythagoreans died. Pythagoras wasn't there at the time. And he ended up in Metapontum, which is a city just down the boot, and lived maybe another 5-10 years there before he died in his 70s. But that's his story. As I said, there's lots of myths about it. But what he did, the ideas that he did, with this approach, conceptual approach, the mathematical approach, getting excited about all his number, have influenced architecture. Architecture, if you look at all the Greek temples, and the Greek theaters and so on, why they look the way they do is because there's a harmonious mathematical relationship between the ratios of different things that they use. This is all not, he didn't come up with all the architectural uses of his idea, but he had this idea about mathematics and harmony, and that if there's direct ratios, numerical ratios, that everything would look a lot better. So he influenced that. He influenced astronomy. He has this idea, which people are still wondering about, called the central fire. He said that the sun and the moon and the stars and the earth all went around the central fire in circles. And he also had a very interesting idea which relates to music, which was that as they spun around, they created a hum which was the harmony of the spheres. There's music of the spheres, that you actually hear something that sounded like music. Now, we know that space is close to a vacuum, not a vacuum, but close to a vacuum, and so you probably wouldn't get any vibrations and there would be no music. But anyway, the idea was there, a nice theoretical idea, which is where he pushed the math and the music to. But there's no other known idea. I mean, there are a couple of other people who maybe you could point to, but this was a unique idea on two counts. One, that the Earth was a sphere, and two, that it went around something else, that it wasn't at the center of the universe. And people think, well, the central fire, he just made that up. But if you count that the stars are in it, that sounds like the Milky Way. You know, it sounds like that everybody's zipping around this much, much bigger thing. So we really don't know, and obviously he didn't have any idea about the vastness of space and how much space there was. But I think if you think, how did these, I mean, the Greeks came up with the atomic theory, too, without any observational ability on the atomic level. And why? Just from logic. If everything is discrete in the world, it has to be made up of discrete things. And if it's all a mush at some level, then you couldn't have any discrete things. And therefore, there must be, at the base level, something that's discrete and indestructible. And that's the atomic theory in a nutshell. So that's just logic of observation. So what was the observation that Pythagoras used? He used the observation of the stars. They did move a little bit, not much, but they moved with the seasons. Now, he could have figured out that maybe it was the Earth spinning, but he could see that they moved. So there's movement in the stars. And what do the stars look like? They look like the little suns. They look like, you know, the children of them. He had no idea how far away they were and therefore what their sizes were. But He could see that the sun was fire. They all kind of understood that. You know, Prometheus, is that whole myth is about taking fire from the sun and bringing it to the planet. So he had this idea because he could see the stars, he could see the earth. And how do you think that the earth was a sphere? From shadows. You know, it's like 99% of the data says one thing, but 1% of the data is confusing. Right? And all good theories are based upon looking at that 1% and figuring out how to turn all the data into something that's coherent. And the way to do that with the eclipses and the shadows at noon and at other times of the day, the way that you can make that into all a coherent theory, because everywhere you look, it looks like the Earth is flat. But if you put all those other pieces of data in with everything else, then you can come up with this idea that the Earth is probably a sphere. Besides the fact that you look at the sun, it looks like a sphere. You look at the moon, it looks like a sphere, so on. So that's obviously an early idea. Now, people argue, did Pythagoras think of that, or was it his followers, and so on and so forth? But it's you know, it's too hard to tell. It's very clear, though, from mathematical history that we have, that both in math and geometry and astronomy, that a large number of people who push things forward, like Euclid and so on, were all considered themselves Pythagoreans, and that they based their inspiration, at least, on this approach towards math, harmony, and let's use numbers to show how beautiful the world is, that the cosmos is a cosmos, that means orderly, rather than a chaos. So that was one of his big ideas, and it also came up with harmony. Now, one of the problems with this approach, which slowed everybody down, but of course you can't do everything right. I always think of, you know, when people say, well, why didn't he think of this or why didn't he think of that? I say, well, you know, the man who invented the car, the first car, did he put backup lights on it? Don't think so. It took a little of experience to realize that if you actually put backup lights on a car, then the cars on the other side would know that you're going in the opposite direction of what the usual is, and therefore you won't hit each other as often. So he got big concepts right and lots of little things, or even some big things, wrong. And one of the big things actually has gone on for a long time, and that is the long philosophical argument about beauty versus truth. Right? That's a long argument. You know, do you go after beauty or do you go after truth? And obviously, Pythagoras was a beauty man. I mean, he was after beauty. He wanted harmony. He wanted beauty. He thought that the planets going around this central fire had to go in perfect circles because perfect circles are just so cool. You know, I mean, that's beautiful. And obviously, he didn't have a good idea about an ellipse, or he might say, well, ellipses are good looking too. But the theory was based on what his imagination thought would be beautiful. It seems, now that we're a little bit more used to science, that we could look at this and say, but before I go into that, I want to say one more thing. He coined the term philosopher. Everybody before him was called a sophist, a wise person, someone who was wise. So it's very similar to the idea of a rishi or a seer in different things, someone who sees what is. But he didn't think that he qualified for that, so he called himself a lover of wisdom, a lover of this information. I'm trying to get there. This is what I'm trying to do. But when you love it, you think of the beauty more than the other thing. And what's ironic is that extra bit of humility was not enough humility, because if you think about it for a second, if you take beauty versus truth, then you're making an assumption about the truth. And the assumption is that it's not beautiful. You're assuming that if you just went after truth, regardless of how beautiful it looked, that the outcome, the end result, the end theory that you had would no longer be beautiful. Otherwise, you'd be saying, I don't need to make a choice between beauty and truth. I'll just go after the truth, and I'm sure it'll be beautiful, because it should make sense. Things should make sense. After all this time now, we've seen so many patterns that show us that the chaos is not all only chaos, that it's very orderly. There are rules. There are things that go on, and it's not the kind of rules we want. Basically, what we wanted for rules was nobody commits murder. Nobody commits rape. Nobody does anything that interferes with my desires in life, basically, it comes down to. And so that's the kind of beauty everybody has been looking for, because that would make us happy if nothing ever happened against our desires, against our will. But of course, that's seeing the whole universe as being, you're the center of the universe and it's all made for you. Now, it's very rational to come up with that idea, because that's how we see the universe. We do look out of our eyes, and it does revolve around us. It all looks like it's there for us. But, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot of stepping back from that to see that that's probably not true. So, this extra humility of saying that the truth is probably going to prove to be more beautiful than anything I can imagine is something he didn't take. But this idea about the beauty of the astronomical world is what inspired Copernicus and other people later on to actually figure out what the mathematics actually were. We're still figuring out what the mathematics actually are. There's lots of theories today that probably will not hold up under mathematical rigorously clear thinking. But that's a different topic. So those are all the other things. Music. He had this idea about music being based on mathematical harmonies. He experimented with it. He thought, how can these harmonies go together? Now, obviously, they did not create the symphony orchestra, right? That came 1,000, 2,000 years later, 1,500 years later. People developed over time all kinds of other things, developing those harmonies. But all those harmonies in the orchestra are based upon this mathematical assumption of how an octave works. And he had a totally different use for music. It was in medicine. He used music, harmonious music, to cure mental illness. And he used it a lot. He thought that if it's very nice and calming and orderly, that the very disorderly, anxious mind would relax into a more orderly and calm state. Now, there were a lot of spas that built up, and actually Hippocrates and Galen, two Greeks known for medicine, both used Pythagorean ideas for helping to solve some of the mental illness issues using music. And they had spas where that was one of the things that was done to help people out. They also took his idea about clear concepts and so on and started to do real scientific research on medicine. So that also, you know, just the idea. Now, our cultures, all the cultures, all human cultures, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, but they're all based on ideas. They're all based on ideas that we have. And some of the ideas are deep philosophical, theoretical ideas that somebody got excited about and got in. And some are total, wildly inaccurate ideas, but they still are very influential. And some are just cultural ideas, you know, I mean, just ideas that somebody favored a fashion, a fad. Some fads last a long time. Some Chinese emperor liked women with tiny feet. And for 300 years, mothers squashed their children's feet so that the emperor would like that. Now the emperor was long gone. So it's important that an idea be analyzed for its reasonableness and its effectiveness in producing happiness in our culture, because that's really what we're after. But ideas are really behind almost every base. If you look at it, you can say, why do people think it's wonderful to be a victim? I won't go into that one. But there's deep cultural reasons why. You went back 2,500 years ago, you would find no culture that celebrated being a victim. Never. So it has to do with attaching to victimness beauty and truth and justice or something like that that makes then people do something that really is against their own interests. So in the concept of how important music is in the West, how important it is in our lives, one of the things that he did in terms of, you know, using it for mental illness was that he figured that music was an expression of our emotions. You know, our emotions are our automatic mental responses to life. We can't really do anything directly about them. If you change your thoughts, you change your philosophy, you change your ideas, your emotions will change. One of my examples for this is, you know, you can have the same experience and the emotions will be different every time. For example, if you're 4 years old and you're playing with your Barbie dolls and your brothers come in and pull off the heads and rip up the clothes and run out laughing, you have a certain emotional reaction to that experience. If you're now 12 years old and you have stored those damaged dolls up on your shelf someplace, and you come home from school, middle school, and you find your teenage brothers now have just come in, taken apart your whole doll set, ripped it all apart, and thrown the heads all around just for old time's sake. You have a different reaction. It's not exactly as traumatic, although it reminds you of the trauma from before. And when you're 23 years old and somebody comes and rips off the head of one of your dolls, you think, oh, I've gone through this so many times before, this is nothing. But when you're 35 and your own daughter is playing with her Barbie dolls and you're getting back to the excitement of it and your own sons come in and rip the heads off, then you have yet another layer of emotional reaction. And each one of those experiences, the emotions are based upon what you think about how important that experience is, what it means to you, and so on. There's a nice story that Mark Twain told about his daughter when she was 4 years old. Her mother said to her, "Don't cry about that. That's just a little thing." Something about what something went wrong with one of her dolls. She thought about it for 3 or 4 days, and she went back to her mother and she said, "Mama, what are little things?" And that's the nut of the matter, because when we see the world through our own eyes, what concerns us is never little. It doesn't make any difference how little it is to other people. So that's just a short explanation about how our emotions respond, and that's why when a composer of any kind of music, all the different varieties of music, the composer is expressing the emotions in his language of music. And there are people who cannot feel this when the music is being played, but almost everybody feels that emotion. You can not hear the words. You can not know the words to a song, for example, in another language. You can't understand it, but you'll know, is it a sad song, or is it a happy song, or is it a nostalgic song? Each of these things is a little like the quality of the musical emotion. It's a little like the quality of laughter. When you hear laughter, if you're at a party and across the room you hear laughter, you can kind of tell what kind of joke it was, even though you didn't hear the joke. You can tell what type of humor it must have been just by the quality of the laugh. And we can almost all tell cruel laughter. And, you know, it's not just the cackling of witches, you know, but that's an extreme version of it. You can tell what a cruel laugh is because somebody is enjoying inflicting pain on somebody else. And we can feel it right away. And so that's what I mean by the quality of emotions. That's what I think is expressed in the quality of music that people devise. And of course, a lot of music is designed to get, you know, our erotic impulses going or whatever. You know, there's all kinds of music designed for a lot of different emotional reasons. And so music is playing off of our automatic mental responses. That's why I didn't play any music today. I thought I wanted to play off of your thinking apparatus. So what Pythagoras did was slip a different idea into the music mix, explain it, say what it could be used for, and other people ran with all kinds of different ideas downstream from that. And that was his contribution in the area of music. And why it's interesting when you take somebody that has influenced so many different areas, you know, somebody can say it must have been a committee, but it's much more likely to be one person who has some unusual way of looking at things than a committee that happened to be have a star in each of those areas, because ideas are generated by minds observing what's going on in reality and then trying to explain them. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're wrong, and sometimes they're half right and half wrong. But since most people aren't in a position to really judge, they just keep going through reality, going through our culture. For 2,000 years, it can go, and nobody will ever pay attention to a really obvious, glaring problem. And it takes somebody who's willing to just say, you know, maybe everybody has been wrong about this for a long time. Entirely possible. So that's Pythagoras' influence on music, and he certainly thought music matters. Thank you very much. So it's time for questions and answers. There's a microphone right over here. We won't do it with the cards. If anybody has a question, they can just go up to the mic. And if you'd like to ask a question and you're not near the mic and don't want to walk, just tell me and I'll come and give you the mic.
Could I make a comment?
Sure.
So somebody told me there is a group in San Francisco called Heroes Voices that teaches veterans who have PTSD mm-hmm. to sing, to play guitar, to take part in music, and it raises their endorphins, and it's really very good for them. And that's what I thought of when you spoke about Pythagoras.
It has been used a lot. I mean, obviously, it's interesting. We are very empathic people. We care about other people's pain and suffering. It's very interesting that we do that. That's a whole other topic. But there's a lot of different things that people use, saying, I can see you're in pain. What can I do to help you come out of that pain? And what I find interesting is that what's most effective is when people share what worked for them. If you're convinced that something works for you, you're much, much better at convincing somebody else to give it a try. I have a theory about this altogether. If you know, there's a lot of people, this is a little Pythagorean for a second on the mystical side, but all kinds of people believe in astrology. All kinds of people believe in palm reading. All kinds of people believe in similar things. Fortune telling, gypsies, and so on and so forth. It seems to me that what they all have in common, to the extent that they work, most of the, you can dismiss about 80% as just shams anyway, and then maybe partially shams and so on, but it seems that there's something there that's working or it wouldn't be still in our culture. And so if you look at it, what is it? It's that the person who practices whatever they're practicing believes that that gives them the ability to see into the other person's life. And therefore, it probably just breaks down their fear because they have confidence, and they have confidence that they can do this, and by the confidence, there's no fear, and they can see into the other person's mind. They can read their thoughts or to that extent, and then they can tell them something about what's going on. They can tell them something about their lives. But, you know, if you give your astrology chart to three different ones, they come up with totally different things. And if somebody knows you, they often know exactly what to tell you. So it has a lot to do with, as all life does, it has a lot to do with what are our fears and how much do they inhibit us. Even these tiny little fears are enough to inhibit us from doing all kinds of things, even just talking to a stranger in an elevator or whatever. You know, I mean, even when there's no risk at all, almost. Go ahead.
I don't think this is a question. It's more of a comment. I was really struck when you're talking about the Pythagorean theorem and how his ability to generalize from one very, well, it's important but small observation to the idea that, oh, if this is a constant, what other constants are there?
Yeah.
And generalize again and again, you know, from the specific to the general. And that's it's just a very, you know, he must have had an amazing intellect to be able to look at something small and then go, you know, multiple orders of generalization away from that. So
yeah. And those of you who are interested in ideas probably can get an idea about how exciting that must have been for Pythagoras to figure out. Because you if you figure that out, you figure out what the possibilities are, or that you just open a big wide door to a large number of possibilities. And let me point out one other thing about this concept, because these concepts are being used all the time too. There's the concept of eternity, right? And we talk about eternity very, very loosely all the time. Concepts running through. It's not defined. We don't really know what it is. It's used for all kinds of things. It means outside of time, this, that, and the other thing. And people say, oh, in the other world or in another world, time is different, space is different. And even in scientific theories, in a black hole, time moves backwards, you know, and so on and so forth. These are all due to delusional assumptions that people are basing their ideas on. You know, you define your concepts and you say, Time, we're going to measure by the speed of, I'm going to pick on the physicist first. Time, you know, you measure by the speed of light. The speed of light is an absolute because the Michelson-Morley experiment showed that it doesn't change based on the observer. Okay? So we now have an absolute speed of light. So we've attached time to that, and now light photons, we know at black holes, are slowed down as they try to get out, stopped, and turned around and go backwards. And the conclusion is that time slows down, turns around, and goes backwards. But it's because you attached it to the speed of light. If the speed of light can, if a photon can slow down, stop, and then be pulled backwards, it is not an absolute. It's a relative function. It's a velocity like anything else. But you attach it to that, you come up with a totally different concept about black holes. And of course, the mathematics points you in that direction. But clear conceptual thinking is much more effective than mathematics when it comes to ideas like that. Because, you know, that's a whole other topic. That's a good example. Yes, Jojo.
I think it's fascinating that he was using music to help people with mental illness. And, of course, I have to then broaden that by saying, doesn't music tell you a lot about each different age? For example, the rock music is so different from opera music and what goes on with emotion. Now, what kind of mental illness was around Samos, where I've been, believe it or not, number one, and what type of musical instruments, or was it just people singing? Do you know that?
They had musical instruments, lyre, so on and so forth. And mostly it was singing, but there were musical instruments as well. What kind of mental illness were they? Same ones that we have today. Anxiety, don't feel you're in control of your life, helplessness. No, it's tough. What is our real experience? We are an individual mind, along with billions of others, on this planet, and that's what we know, and it makes you feel small. Ironically, you see yourself as the center of the universe, but it makes you feel small and helpless, and you want everything to go the way you want to. Where do we get that idea from? Our dreams. No, our dreams pretty much go the way we want them to. We have a lot of nightmares, too. By the way, it just reminds me of a great line in The Economist about Hollywood. It said, Hollywood takes our dreams and our nightmares and gives them back to us with bigger budgets and better bodies. But to go back to your idea about the different kinds of music, for different periods of time, sure, you know, what are your emotions? What are your desires? The desires that get you excited are different at different times of life. And therefore, rock music appeals to teenagers and to 40-year-old men, that are having their second spurt, so to speak. And people who want to calm down love classical music. People who want excitement but partially calm love opera, because it's very dramatic, but it's also beautiful, too, and very elaborate and elegant, because they want to live an elegant life. They want to identify with that kind of thing. So all the different kinds of music are there, appealing to different people for different reasons. And it's not why it's created. It's created by individuals who just express their emotions musically. Right? And they get in a genre that they're comfortable with. It's very hard to cross genres, as people know, because you're basically expressing your own personality in music. And so if you're a Mozart, you're going to express it one way. If you are, Country Joe McDonald, you're going to express it another way. I'm looking forward to hearing him talk, because we really loved his cheer when I was in high school.
George, thank you very much for the informative talk. My question is this. It's easy to understand how certain music can invoke emotional and physical responses. If I hear a Bach minuet, I'm certainly going to want to dance a minuet. The waltzes give us that feeling. Now, if I hear Chuck Berry or, John Lennon doing rock and roll, I feel like rock and roll. Can you tell me what on earth is going to be the historical... What is history going to think about hip-hop and rap? Where are those emotions headed? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, they express extremely popular emotions. And my guess, I'm just going to take, I shouldn't even answer this question, but I'm going to take a guess on it. Most popular, what's very popular, either in music or art, literature, anything, what's most popular needs to be up to date to be popular, right? Because people say, that's what my parents did. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Right? The only thing that crosses that line over time, almost, is classical art and so on. Why? Because there's so little of it. There's so little of it expressing. So few people draw paintings at the level of Raphael and Michelangelo or sculpt as well as them. There's so few people who write as the great classic writers have done, and because they're so, and their great architecture, why? I always think about this like the Pantheon in Rome. Okay, that building has been there for 2,000 years, being used one after another, and Rome went from 1 million people to 30,000 and back again, and it survived. And it's not that the building itself survived that's the miracle. The miracle is that 15 different committees during that 2,000 years had to get together and say, I know it's cheaper to tear it down, but we're going to spend the money to keep it up because we want to see that. And we hope to use other people's money than our own, but if we have to, we'll use our money. It's a small group of people who hold on to these things. Why do we hold on to all those things? We hold on to have faith that humanity has something else on its mind than just war and destruction and, you know, all the small petty things that people are doing. We want to say there are thinkers, there are artists who express something much more sublime, and we're kind of selfish. We spend a lot of money holding on to all those things to keep that faith alive. Well, we just have that faith because it's there. It's real. I mean, there's lots and lots of people who approach life that way. It's not a majority, though.
Yes, I was just going back to the time of Pythagoras. Do you know or do we know if there was a direct school of music that sort of took on his ideas at the time or very close to it? Do we know if there was, he said these
known.
Things.
It's not
let's
known
put it into
sure.
practice.
Yeah. It's not known for sure. It's very hard. I mean, opera is, Kip, those of you who heard Kip Crenna on Wednesday last week said, you know, opera in 1600 was an attempt to recover ancient Greece's music form, but no one knew what it was like. No one knew what it sounded like. No one had any evidence for it, but they knew that they did it because it was written about. And I think that it's probably clear that this art form developed not as a result of the Pythagorean society, but as a result of some of those ideas of harmony and in music that he set up. And so there was a lot of, pastoral music, and there was this elaborate thing that had developed. And that elaborate thing is probably at least partially based, just like the architecture is, on Pythagorean number theory and harmonic theory. But we really don't know, probably. And let me finish John's thing on hip-hop. I mean, I think hip-hop and rap are popular with people who find that the way they feel about life. And I think that they will, most of those people's children and grandchildren will feel the same way but not want to express it in that music because that's old-fashioned, their grandfathers and everything. It's just like people go back to the 19th century and said, why today in the 21st century don't we have so many good writers as we had in the 19th century with Melville and Hemingway, that's the 20th century, but, with Melville and Hawthorne and so on and so forth. Why don't we have them now? You know, they're the ones who are left. There were a lot worse writers in the 19th century than there are today. Lots and lots of really lousy books. And they were much more popular than Melville and Hawthorne and the others. And some of those writers, totally forgotten except for somebody, some specialist in the English department someplace. That's what popular culture does. The artistry that goes at the top end of human culture is lasting because the people at this appreciation level for this kind of art wants to hold on to it. We want to hold on to it because there's so little of it. It's ironic. But as I said about Michelangelo, if there were 10,000 people who could paint like Michelangelo today, we probably would let the Sistine Chapel, disintegrate. We wouldn't try to recreate it. If there were 100,000 Da Vinci's, we wouldn't care that the Last Supper was falling apart and spend billions of 100,000 or millions of dollars on trying to keep it there to remind us that he did this. So I think, once we get those numbers, we will be able to discard the past. But we won't have discarded it. We'll have implemented the ideas much more effectively. That to me is a much more interesting way to be happy. Although in the meantime, I'm 100% in favor of saving everything that we can keep our hands on. Yeah.
I thank you very much. Learned a lot about Pythagoras, but as a musician, I'd like to know a little bit more about his connection with music. I'd like to know, for example, other than the fact that he said that music is based on mathematical harmonies. What else did he do or say? What was his connection? What was music like? What were there instruments? What was the choral music? There must be something more than just the sentence that he was that he believed that music was based on mathematical harmony. What was his other contribution to his?
Unknown. It's said, you know, that he sang. There's no evidence that there were the kind of large operatic type musical productions that were available 100, 150 years later in Athens. So the lyre obviously was already around. Other musical instruments were around, string instruments. There were really early, not guitar like, but other versions of the lyre, more strings. There's, you know, of course, in Asia, the Chinese instruments. There were several instruments in both India and China were already available at that time too. But there's, you know, we're talking about four or five. As far as I know, there were no saxophone, brass type instruments. There was no piano, obviously. There were none of the more elaborate things. But this was basically a little bit more like the harmonic tone that you use to get a chorus to start singing on thing. The lyre was to get the right tone so that the singers could sing to that tone. His influence on music was that if you're trying to create a lush harmony, if you're trying to create an elaborate piece of music, look to the mathematics of your instrument. Look to constructing. I'll give you another example. If he hadn't thought of that, somebody else would, let's say. But whoever thought of that first is responsible for somebody else constructing a piano 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 years later. Because without that idea, you would never have constructed a piano. You would never have constructed the more elaborate. You would never have thought about how to take a brass instrument and make the sounds work. Because the first sound that you make, the sounds terrible. As anyone who has had a child try this, you know, knows. And so it's knowing that there's a mathematical basis to harmony that allowed people to devise instruments that could create those harmonies, not only within the one instrument, but along with other instruments with totally different sounds. I know that doesn't seem like much, you know, because it's just theoretical. But I'm an ideas guy, and it seems to me that ideas, once you have the ideas, you can delegate the rest of the work to somebody else. So all right. There's time for one more question.
Just to comment on what you said. Also, what you're saying is you're talking about Western harmony.
Right.
You're talking about the tempered scale. And I understand Pythagoras' contribution to that, but just there is an awareness that there's other forms of music. There's other right. forms of scales. There's quarter tones. There's Indian music, which doesn't deal with those mathematical relations, although you probably could come up with
probably some. Could come up with them, but they're not based on that. That's right, yeah. And that's the difference. And you know, it's a little bit unfair that this was devised in the West, you know, because it kind of trains your ear to appreciate that kind of harmony and not other forms of harmony, you know, because that's what you're used to hearing. And the same thing is true in India and China. You're used to a different form of harmony or a different form of sound that is pleasing, even if it's not mathematically harmonious and therefore you can build up a lush rhythm behind it. But obviously the drum rhythms and so on and so forth have been around for thousands and thousands of years that are behind the other sounds that go with them. So there's no, you know, it's true. That's why I say that the Western music is distinctive, most probably because of that mathematical basis of the harmony. But that doesn't mean the other stuff isn't music. Music is our emotional expression in sound of what's going on inside us. And just one last optimistic thing about music. Those who say that all the best music has all been written and all you know, there's no way to write anything else and how could you ever have a new pop song and all that, that's just so pessimistic for no reason. All it is, you know, whatever our emotions are, we're going to express. Our emotions aren't going away. And if our emotions get better, one could expect the music to get better. Thank you very much. So ends another lecture at the Commonwealth Club in its 113th year of enlightened discussion.